Hi, it is September 8th, and this is another episode of The Right Side with Andrea, me, and Kim. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm caffeinated and ready to talk about the crazy week that we just had.
Oh, I know. I know. I've had about as much C-SPAN for a while now. I think I'll be okay.
The long national nightmare known as the hearings, they're over.
Yeah, so until the vote's done, then we'll be. But we have a great guest right with us to talk about it. Senior Judicial Fellow of Americans for Prosperity, Casey Maddox, is here. How are you, Casey?
I'm doing great. Great to be on.
Yeah, thank you for coming on here and talking about this with
us.
So, just to kind of start off, Kim, you had written a couple posts about what we knew was going to happen. So, do you want to kind of like give a little bit of synopsis of just how much we knew this stuff was going to be happening?
Oh, sure. Definitely. On August 10th is when Chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, announced that the hearings would be on September 4th. So from that moment on, it's been doom and gloom. And if you survived the tax cuts, the Paris Accord, and whatever, oh, net neutrality, if you've survived all that, then you were still here for the Kavanaugh hearings, and they were sure to be explosive and horrible and gut-wrenchingly just awful to watch and deal with. And that was just us in the audience. I cannot imagine what Judge Kavanaugh was going through. But once the news came out that the hearings would be on September 4th, like I said, it was kind of an end of the world. Everything will come crashing down then. Especially people in Congress, especially Kamala Harris, Dianne Feinstein, others directly involved in the hearings, were so obsessed with the fact that they did not believe that there were enough documents that were being released to review before the hearings. They did not believe there was enough time to review the documents before the hearings. So I guess the first thing that we heard was, you know, the documents, we need more time, we need more documents in general. So that was something that we knew was going to come up. Also, especially because this is a Republican president nominating a Republican. Well, I think actually he's done the hearings. I don't know if he's registered Republican.
He's allowed to be. And we can talk about that with Casey. But that was kind of like the very beginning that we knew about. No, Casey, he's not allowed to be a registered Republican, correct? Like, he doesn't even vote?
Well, yeah, he said he didn't vote, I think.
Yeah, he doesn't. He could. Okay. Judges are perfectly free to do that if they want to. But he has chosen to basically take a pretty extreme version of judicial independence where he doesn't even vote, he said, as part of the hearing. So that, I thought that was very interesting. His thought process seems to be, he wants to keep as much distance between the politics and the judging as he can, which, whether you agree or disagree with whether or not he should be voting and, acknowledging a party affiliation or anything like that. I mean, it's commendable that, placing such a priority on judicial independence that he's even deciding he's not going to vote. Of course, now a lot of us may be looking at the current state of politics and kind of envying his ability to have a justification for just not voting, but
we went through that part with the hearing and everything, but of course the biggest issue was Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. The Democrats and most people on the left have been up in arms about the fact that if he is seated, then Roe v. Wade would be overturned. Women would not have access to contraception. Actually, Yale law students and some alumni, they had an open letter. There was an open letter favorable of Kavanaugh, but there was also one saying, literally, people will die if he is confirmed. And then also on top of the documents and the Roe v. Wade focus was also the fact that he, if he's seated, would have stolen Merrick Garland's seat, the nominee that Obama wanted to get on the Supreme Court. So that was just kind of the background once we knew that the hearings were going to happen. Like I said, we knew they were going to be explosive. aggressive. But I'm not sure about you guys, but they were actually much worse than I thought, especially, I guess, at the very beginning. I could not believe what was going on with the Democrats trying to stall, essentially. So, yeah, that's a little bit of the background. But let me just say one more thing about the documents on August 10th when the hearing was scheduled. Well, they announced that it was going to be on September 4th. There was, let's see, released a little memo about facts about Kavanaugh documents, and these were some of the things. I actually read this when I wrote a piece on the day of the announcement. It said in there that Judge Kavanaugh has been on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals for 12 years. He has issued 307 opinions and joined hundreds more. The documents submitted to the Senate Judiciary Committee pertaining to Judge Kavanaugh's time serving in the White House Counsel and Independent Counsel's Office are the largest number of executive branch records ever submitted to the committee. Judge Kavanaugh returned the most comprehensive bipartisan Senate questionnaire in Judiciary Committee history, and Senator Grassley has allotted more time between the nominations of Kavanaugh and the start date of the hearings than those set aside for Kagan, Sotomayor, and Gorsuch. So I thought those were some key points that, although were true, we didn't really hear those at the beginning or throughout the hearing, except by Republicans that were trying to correct the record after the Democrats would talk. So yeah, that's a little bit of a summary before.
Yeah. So, so Casey, when it came to the actual opening statements, everybody got to go around and have a lengthy intro of what they thought about Judge Kavanaugh. What were versus the let's start with the Democrats when they did their opening statements, it was largely just theatrics at that point, correct? Like there was no real kind of substance in them that was worth anything.
You know, yeah, and it even frankly seemed, I think a lot of people have been saying this, it basically seemed like it was orchestrated. You know, at least among the Democrats, if not the Democrats and the protesters who were there. But it certainly seemed like it was an orchestrated plan to try to distract from Judge Kavanaugh and instead make it about basically anything other than Judge Kavanaugh. Because if you actually look at him, you have someone who has been 12 years as a judge, who has issued 307 opinions. The American Bar Association decided he was very well qualified for the bench. So, you know, it's difficult to attack Judge Kavanaugh. Even, you know, I as a husband and father sit there and frankly feel guilted hearing this guy's story and you know, thinking like, why am I not coaching soccer? I should be coaching my kid's soccer team. And you know, he's just this incredible person that frankly just, you know, you hear his story and you just want to emulate him. And so in order to distract from that, you basically had this you know, all of this emphasis placed on who got what documents and when. Not that any of those documents are necessarily useful to anyone. I mean, one of the fascinating things with this guy is that you have, you know, half a million documents, I think, close to it, that have actually been produced that the committee has. And despite the fact that he is, as some people have said, kind of the Forrest Gump of Republican politics, he's been involved in, you know, in just about everything for the last 20 years, it seems like, various administrations and the Ken Starr investigation. And yet, despite all of that, he manages to say really nothing that's controversial in all of those documents. That's pretty shocking.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about myself and my Twitter feed and how much I have disqualified myself from the bench. But you know, I look at this guy and think, how can you be in all of these battles? But I think it basically just speaks to his character. You know, he's not thinking politically for the most part. He's basically thinking like someone who's who's interested in the legal issues that are at play.
And even the things that even the things that they tried to make big deals out of that were in emails that, you know, like Cory Booker, were ultimately in big nothings.
No, that's right. I mean, you have this Cory Booker, you know, his I am Spartacus moment, which, by the way, when that I heard someone else say that he had said, I am Spartacus, you know, this is my Spartacus moment.
Yes.
And when I heard that, I thought, I'm assuming that this was like, you know, it's rumored that he said this in a hallway after the hearing or something like that. Because I thought surely he obviously didn't just say with a straight face sitting in the committee hearing, this is my Spartacus moment. And then I saw the clip and realized, no, that's actually what happened. You have these emails that finally come out. This big moment for Cory Booker releasing these emails, and it's basically Judge Kavanaugh saying, you know, I have some reservations about this idea of using race as a means of determining who we're going to search after 9/11. So basically, that's the big reveal, is that you have a Republican who's opposed to using race after 9/11 to target people.
A monster, really. That's what he is.
It's really amazing. I mean, you would think that these are the kinds of things that would make Democrats say, okay, well, maybe he's not as bad as we thought he was. This guy actually seems to be a pretty straight shooter. And you would hope that that's what it means. That's one of the discouraging things I think I've seen out of these hearings is that we have a real dearth of good people in politics. Mm-hmm. You look at Washington, D.C., one of the problems we have, frankly, is we do not send our best people to Washington, D.C. to represent us in Congress.
Do you think that's a symptom of what happens to good people when they try to run for office? Just the ragging that they get?
I mean, you basically, exactly. I mean, you're going to get torn apart, right? I mean, you look at someone like Judge Kavanaugh, this seems like basically someone who, left or right, you should look at and think, this is a good person. I mean, to kind of balance it out, I'll say, I think I disagree a lot with Justice Kagan, but I think similarly, I think she's a pretty decent person who just is wrong on a whole lot of issues. But she seems like a decent person overall. You look at Judge Kavanaugh, this is someone who you would absolutely love to have this person as your neighbor. He's the kind of person that, look, if we're going to have Republicans in politics, if you're the Democrats and you've accepted the idea that there are going to be Republicans in politics, he's the kind of guy you want. A decent, good person who seems to have the country's interests at heart. And instead, what we do is they manage to tear the guy apart personally. And that's disturbing.
One thing I noticed during the hearing, and maybe this is just because I didn't watch much of the Gorsuch hearing. I think I maybe caught a little bit of other hearings, recently, Sotomayor and Kagan, but not very much at all. I watched most of this one, unfortunately. But there is such a focus on the Ginsburg rule, which people, I guess they have short memory, but they did not really remember that Ginsburg had kind of laid this foundation during her hearings, and all these other nominees had done the same exact thing when they were seated in the same position in front of the committee. And the Free Beacon had a flashback after they had did a flashback video, I should say, after the Democrats were talking about how Kavanaugh would not answer certain questions that were, from the committee members when they were talking about how he would rule, like hypothetically if certain issues came up. So they published this video as a flashback of years of the Ginsburg rule. And every single nominee, there was, like I said, Ginsburg and Souter, Alito, Roberts, Kagan, Sotomayor, all of them, Gorsuch too. When they were asked about, like I said, how they would rule hypothetically, they all said that that's something that they can't discuss because that is, muddying the waters of how they should act as a judge when they should look at the cases as they come and take them at that moment instead of kind of saying, well, I would probably do this based on this subject matter or what. It was interesting to me that a lot of Democrats, maybe a little bit on the committee, but definitely in the punditry world, were talking about how, well, he wouldn't answer the questions that were, given to him. But that's really, that's what he should have been doing. And that's what everyone's been doing, right?
Yeah, it's play acting. They know that. And, they've been around to these hearings long enough. They know how this works. And, there's two very good reasons for why that rule exists. And frankly, why the hearings are, for the most part, a complete waste and we should do away with them. But the two very good reasons are one, a lot of these issues do come back before the court. And, I'm imagining as an attorney, I've filed briefs with the Supreme Court before. If there was a nice long list of, which judge has said what at which hearing about which precedents that they plan to overrule, well, that certainly changes the way I argue the case to the court. And you can be certain that there are going to be briefs that are citing the judge's words about, you know, prior precedent to them. It changes even the way cases play out in the lower courts, because lower courts are supposed to follow Supreme Court precedent. But, you know, if you can actually count that there are, you know, 5-6 judges who have said that they would overrule prior precedent, well, you know, maybe lower courts just start overruling preemptively. So it changes the law, and that's, you know, this is not, that's not a good practice. The other big reason I think that you don't want to do that is reasons like we saw from Kamala Harris this week. It would be one thing if these senators were capable of hearing what the nominee says, not demagoguing it, and, you know, agreeing or disagreeing with the positions that they're holding. But, you know, for example, he's describing how the Priest for Life case in the D.C. Circuit, how that case played out. He literally quotes, this is what Priest for Life argued, and Kamala Harris took out the portion where he said, this is what Priest for Life said, treated it as his own words, and starts tweeting that out and making these claims. And, of course, now a number of media outlets have picked up on that same approach, putting words in his mouth when he's just saying, this is what the litigants before me in a case argued. That's, you know, he knows better. At least, you know, frankly, I hope she does. As a sitting senator, I hope she understands that there's a difference between, you know, this is what the parties are arguing, and this is my own view, my own personal view.
Yeah, I mean, when you see very, you know, what you would assume or hope to be very smart people, you know, it's like Kim and I are friends with one of the people who sits on the board of Planned Parenthood. I mean, friends in a very loose, like, more kind of like, you know, we have a dialogue. But, you know, he, you know, someone like that, he's a university professor, and he shared that that clip like that. And, you know, you sit there. I mean, of course, he has an agenda behind why he would do that. But it was, you know, it's very smart people not doing their due diligence and just, you know, finding unedited video before sharing it on social media. So
no, it's things you want to believe, right? Because mm-hmm. they're quite useful things to believe. If they were true, then it would be quite a great you know, opportunity to use as a target. But, you know, it doesn't matter what the truth is. If you can just you know, create a nice meme, then, you know, you can use that as a tool against someone. So I mean, it's unfortunate, but that's exactly why, if you're a Supreme Court justice, it makes very little sense to reveal much about what you believe, because it's not going to be treated fairly.
Yeah. So you,
when I was listening, I'm sorry, Andrea.
I was just going to,
we can't see each other. That's why
I know. We always say that. I'll just jump in really quick, 'cause I want to touch on this really quick. Is that you mentioned, you know, getting rid of the hearings. You know, people have said, like, why, of course that would create a major, you know, backlash, especially on the left, you know, where, but clearly when they talk about even, you know, cameras in the Supreme Court, you know, like that would politicize that in itself would politicize the court. So is there any mechanism to just stop these hearings? Would Democrats and Republicans, or do they all kind of, you know, is there any hope of that ever happening, where they stop having them or televising them, where everybody can just, the real interested people could get transcripts of them if they did still hold them?
You know, I'm really torn, because, I mean, frankly, I sit and watch these things, and I watch just about the entirety of the week's hearings, and think this is completely useless. There's no purpose being served. And frankly, it's causing... you know, I think the fact that you put the cameras on Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, and probably some on the Republican side too, you know, just invites the process to be even worse. At the same time, you know, I think it's a good thing that when you have elected leaders that we have some scrutiny on them. I want to be able to know how they're doing, what they're doing. And so, you know, transparency is for the government, and I want them to be transparent with how they're conducting business. So frankly, I don't really have a great answer for how we should do this, other than, you know, we've got to figure out some way to change the process so that, you know, look, if a Supreme Court justice is already saying, I am not going to answer questions about how I rule on X, Y, or Z case, I mean, maybe those questions are just out of order. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you steer them back toward, look, let's talk about more general judicial philosophy. Now, from some of that, you can get an idea of, you know, how a judge would rule in a specific case. But the charade of, will you guarantee me that you will vote this way on Roe v. Wade, or vote this way on, you know, Humphrey's executor, or whatever the issue is at the moment that they're talking about in these hearings, they're not going to decide that. So they're not going to say that. So we need some way of sort of having these hearings be at least somewhat productive.
Yeah. Kim?
Yes, when I was listening to, I think it was Lindsey Graham, when he was one of his turns and talking about just kind of the state of what was happening in the chambers and just the ruckus and everything in the audience and all that, he was discussing how previous nominees who had been appointed and confirmed and were seated on the Supreme Court, what their Senate totals were as far as the yays or nays. And it kind of struck me as odd because things are so contentious right now. And it made me think that a Kavanaugh vote, especially since it's the second nominee from President Trump, that his vote will be substantially less than what other people got as far as the yays are concerned. But he mentioned, Graham mentioned, let's see, when Ginsburg was appointed, she got, I think, like 93 votes. Votes in the Senate or something for confirmation, and Scalia got something like 98. Now, I don't know how many, and I think Kagan and Sotomayor were up there too. I'm not sure how many Gorsuch got, but as far as Kavanaugh, especially in the time we are right now with the second nominee from a very, very hated president, how many votes do you think he's going to get as far as confirmation votes for the Senate? I mean, is it something you think I think he'll be confirmed, but will it be kind of like, oh, he'll get 85, 90 votes, or is it going to be kind of a call? I'm interested in what you think about that.
Yeah, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's going to end up being closer to about 55 votes. I think that's probably about where I would put the over-under, 54, 55 votes. Mm-hmm. I think there will be a handful of Democrats who will vote to confirm. And of course, you know, there was a time quite recently when that would have been insufficient to confirm because the filibuster was in place. Mm-hmm. And Democrats could have, with under 60 votes, Democrats could have stopped that. That was changed, of course, by Harry Reid, and that's where we are now. So, but, I, you know, I think there's it's unlikely that they're going to be more than just a handful of Democrats. And those are basically, I think, because they're going to feel political pressure. People like Senator Manchin in West Virginia, Donnelly in Indiana, Heitkamp perhaps. There are a few who are going to feel political pressure because of their states and the fact that they have elections coming up this fall. But it's unfortunately, it's become a very partisan decision. And it's, you know, I think that's how we'll expect to see it play out.
Which is unfortunate because you said, I mean, he has 12 years as a judge and we have all these records and he's one of the least political out there as far as his background. And you can tell, like you said, that generally, whether you're on the left or right, that he seems like a good, decent man. And he has been very focused and measured in his decisions in the past. So the fact that he will maybe just eke by and be confirmed, it says a lot about, you know, the political state we're in right now.
It does. It also says, I think, a lot about the way we treat the court now. I mean, we have, you know, I think Ben Sasse probably said it much better than I ever could, but in the hearings the other day, we've just placed all of our political choices into the hands of the Supreme Court at this point, either the Supreme Court or administrative agencies. You have Congress essentially passing the buck to either or both, asking the agencies to pass well. They will pass legislation that is essentially goals legislation that says, you know, the goal is, you know, we want health care. So here, HHS, you fill in the blanks. And the blanks are basically all of the difficult choices. You know, how is this going to get paid for? How much is it going to get, have, you know, all the decisions that end up actually affecting how much it's going to cost. The HHS mandate, of course. All those sorts of contentious issues that would have prevented the thing from actually getting the votes to pass, they just punt it over to HHS. And on the other questions, and they'll, you know, they'll be wrestling with, well, is this or is this not constitutional? Or do we not have authority to actually enact the statute? Let's just pass it on to the Supreme Court and let them make a call about whether we did or didn't. We don't have to make that call. So when you are passing those essentially political decisions that we should be holding our members of Congress, the president, and holding them responsible for, you pass those over to unelected judges, then you have a process like you saw play out this week.
Yeah, and what do you see as we know, time and again, Republican nominees, not so far Gorsuch, but he's only been on the court for a very short amount of time. But now, if once Kavanaugh's on the bench, is there going to be anything where what kind of real changes do you think is actually going to be different now that Justice Kennedy is off the bench and we have, I know we don't know until we know kind of thing. Cause right. John Roberts was supposedly very conservative. But the chances of Roe v. Wade and Casey being, kind of overturned, like they are saying, that would necessitate a actual case being brought forward and then, some major changes. So,
yeah, and I think the reality is that the Republican justices tend to be cautious anyway. The more conservative judges tend to be conservative, not just in their, what you might think of as political views, but also in the way that they want to rule. And so they tend to be much more incremental with any of those more difficult questions, because mm-hmm. part of their mindset is we want these decisions to be made by legislatures, and so sweeping decisions in the other direction. So, I think there is a kind of a natural throttle on these, how far things swing. Justice Kennedy, particularly this last term, was, didn't really look like the swing judge at all. I think there were actually a number of cases where Justice Gorsuch was more the swing justice than Judge Justice Kennedy was. And Justice Roberts. So, he had a pretty, what one would think of as a conservative term, with his decisions on speech and Masterpiece and others. So, it's hard to know exactly how much of a change that one, should really expect, with replacing Justice Kennedy with Justice Kavanaugh. So, but, we're just not going to be able to know on some of these issues. He does seem like someone who has a view of the administrative state that he wants to see the burden placed back on Congress. So mm-hmm. I think that may be one place where you can expect some change.
One more question I had about the hearings was, I don't know if, like I said, this was in some other hearings, because I've only watched a little bit of the most recent ones before this one, but especially Feinstein and I think some of the other senators, they were so focused on asking Kavanaugh if he believed something was settled law, especially Roe v. Wade, if he believed it was correct law, if it was correctly decided. And I thought that was kind of a big shift in how they ask a nominee something. Maybe I had missed that in, like I said, previous hearings, but I found that rather odd. I mean, they can't really say whether the court that they're not on has correctly decided something. They can talk about whether they correctly decided something, in his past, in his past 12 years as a judge. But as far as saying whether something was correctly decided by another body, that's kind of like the Ginsburg rule. I mean, you can't really say anything about what you think opinion-wise on that, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically another way of asking, will you vote to overturn these decisions, right? I mean, that's essentially what they're trying to get at.
Yeah.
It's just another way of framing that exact question. Because they realize that if a judge says something is settled law, I mean, frankly, it's a relatively meaningless term. What does it mean to say something is settled law? The Supreme Court could overrule any of its prior decisions, and no one disputes that, right? If the Supreme Court overturned Marbury versus Madison, it could. It would, for the reasons that Judge Kavanaugh gave in the hearing, that, look, that's actually based squarely in the Constitution, the idea of judicial review. But you know, they can overturn any prior decision. That's the prerogative of the Supreme Court. So, you know, he's there. It's kind of a meaningless idea to ask if it's just settled law. And so they try to come up with other formulations to basically ask, will you overturn this prior decision? And he's just not going to answer that for the same reasons that Justice Ginsburg wouldn't.
Yeah, right. I mean, and Kavanaugh kind of even, you know, they tried to make hay a little bit out of Kavanaugh having written that, you know, I can't remember if it was in a book or an email or his Georgetown law. I mean, there was paperwork that was, you know, that was being thrown around all over the place that he had said, you know, well, you know, the Supreme Court can kind of, you know, nothing's really settled because the Supreme Court can do what it wants. You know, it's kind of, that's what it's there for. Right. But so just to kind of wrap things up, was there any like main theme that kind of like really got you or amused you or that you really like had an issue with? I guess I'm kind of putting you on the spot, but just as a watcher of like future Supreme Court hearings, and I mean, I don't even know if we're, I mean, unless, you know, people keep on talking about how old Ruth Bader Ginsburg is, but she says that she feels good and is going to serve out until she's serving out. But just as far as this one went, was there anything that kind of stuck out to you particularly this past week besides everything we talked about?
Well, I mean, it's just, yeah, right. I mean, it's just, it was a circus except with a caveat from, for Senator, from Senator Graham that, you know, circuses are normally, entertaining and, something you can invite children to. This was not either of those. No, I mean, it's unfortunate because if you were trying to get a good picture of what this process looks like, this is not how it's supposed to work. And I think ultimately we're going to have, I mean, I think it's basically we have to look at ourselves and figure out how have we gotten this far off the rails. I think we've gotten this far off the rails is because we're basically expecting that the Senate's not going to do anything. Congress doesn't do anything anymore. They don't even pass budgets, much less actually, deal with legislation that would improve the lives of Americans. Instead, they largely pass legislation that passes the buck to someone else to make decisions. And that's how you end up in this process where, one 80-something-year-old man's decision to spend more time with his family puts the country in an absolute moment of chaos. It shouldn't be that way.
Yeah, and the left and Hollywood have just kind of like attached themselves to Ruth Bader Ginsburg like nothing I've ever. Supreme Court justices are quite supposed to be the lauded figures that notorious RBG as they now call her.
So annoying.
But I think at one point
I will add this too. One of the things, you know, as someone on the right, I am often embarrassed by seeing some of the stuff, particularly coming from the alt-right, the insane conspiracy theory stuff that we sometimes saw. And in a strange way, it was almost kind of comforting. That's probably a very bad term to use for this, but it was to see the insanity on the left out of this hearing, the woman sitting behind Kavanaugh and the crazy conspiracy theories about signals that she was supposedly, watching some of that just made me realize that, fortunately for people on the right, the insanity is not limited to the right. There are insane people on both polar ends of the ideological spectrum. And so, that's kind of weirdly comforting to realize that they have their crazy too.
Well, and that was kind of the thing that made it even worse, that made me embarrassed the next day was that the following day, after we spent a day talking about Zina Bash having her hand resting on her other arm in a certain way, going back and forth about that, the next day, a lot of people on the right seeing this still shot of her saying okay to whoever was across the aisle who clearly had said something to her, and she kind of nodded and then did okay. Because you can't say anything. What was she supposed to? And it's like, and they took this quick little thing that she did. If you watch the video, it was so quick. And she was clearly responding to the person who had said something to her, probably Kavanaugh's wife, who was seated right across from her. But, you know, it was the next day, and having, you know, many conservative and Republican people in the media kind of go, oh, this was clearly, you know, she's trolling. This was very immature. It's like, I'm sorry. I do Occam's razor on stuff like this. I'm like, you saying that was, was her trolling is just as conspiracy theory minded as the people saying it's a white power sign.
Right. It's look, this people are sitting in that room for hours and hours and hours on end. As painful as it was for any of us to have to watch at home, imagine having to sit directly behind Kavanaugh for as many hours as she did. I can't even imagine.
Well, and I
the pain that would have been.
Yeah, I actually tweeted this early this morning. I was like, it's like Zina Bash did not sit on. You know, she was sitting in the hearings, not sitting on social media. So maybe, like, if you are so obsessed with Zina Bash, you know, doing an okay sign to someone very quickly, as she's sitting in a room without her phone on, without her, you know, MacBook in her, you know, pants or whatever, like, she's sitting there completely closed off from social media until she goes home, if she goes on social media at all. I just thought that was completely manufactured outrage. Yeah.
All right.
Well, Casey, thank you so much for being here with us.
Yes, thank you.
Hey, well, this has been great. I've known you guys for a long time, and I don't think I've ever actually heard your voices. So this is good to actually be able to do this, and thanks for having me on.
You just outed yourself as not an avid subscriber and listener to this podcast.
Yeah, well, exactly right, yeah. So I just followed you on Twitter, though, so, you know, there you go.
But you are one of the nicer members of the patriarchy. I'm surprised.
Well, I try. you know, we have to keep up appearances.
Yes, so. Well, I thought that was a great summary of the week. It was such a, like, crap show. I was, like, I think you and I both, like, I watched this Tuesday religiously, Wednesday religiously, Thursday almost religiously. I think I missed kind of the end, like, the later in the day, and just because I had things to do. And then yesterday, I honestly thought it was the private hearing, so I didn't even think to look until about, I don't know, 8, 9 o'clock. And I was like, and by then it's 11 o'clock and I was like, man, this has already been going on for like an hour and a half. And so I was just like, ugh. I was like, I can't do another day.
You took one for the team, because I watched most of it on Tuesday. And then the other days I just watched the morning. And then yesterday I did not even care. And I thought they might be over. And when I found out they weren't, it didn't bother me. I didn't want to watch them.
Same questions over and over again.
I know, my gosh, it was horrible. But Casey is so right when he says we put so much emphasis on judges and them deciding, you know, the rule of law and then changing the course of our nation and how things go. It's not a good evolution.
Yeah.
And the fact that Kavanaugh won't, like he said, he might get, what, 55 votes or something in the Senate, when he is pretty nonpartisan, you know, just in his answers and in his record, when other people like Scalia had 98 yes votes in the Senate. I mean, we've gone so far down the rabbit hole. It's just insane.
Can I just say that, you know, the guy that we have been beaten over the head with since Barack Obama nominated him, Merrick Garland, Judge Kavanaugh has joined the opinion of Merrick Garland the vast majority of the time. You're basically getting essentially the same guy. I mean, it may be a little bit different, but I mean, it's just, but still, I mean, it was.
Anyway. It doesn't matter, because we're all going to die when he is seated.
By the way, you can follow Casey at Casey Maddox _ on Twitter. I forgot to have him share that.
M-A-T-T-O-X.
Yes. Yeah. CaseyMaddox_. It's just a symbol. It's not. Don't spell _. Do you remember when back in the early 90s?
Oh,
I was just gonna say. Do you remember back in like the mid 90s when the internet was new and people would have to say www dot, and it's a dot. It's a period dot.
That's so funny. Oh man, that seems like the dark ages.
Yeah. Anyways, what were you gonna say?
Oh well, obviously there was not just the hearing. It wasn't just the hearings this week, even though that seemed to take most of our attention and they were horrible and stuff. But there was some other craziness going on in the news and on Capitol Hill and everything. I'm sure a lot of people saw this, but the exchange between Marco Rubio and Alex Jones when he was there on Wednesday to listen to Sheryl Sandberg and Jack Dorsey talk to the House committee about, you know, censorship and content shadow monitoring banning, and everything.
Yeah.
Yes, and shadow banning. But yeah, in the hallway, you know, there was that little ruckus and my gosh, it was insane. And that, I feel, was not like even the craziest thing when it comes to Alex Jones this week, because he was permanently banned along with InfoWars, permanently banned from Twitter on Thursday, I believe, for abusive behavior. You know, whatever exactly the definition of that was. But we've talked a little bit about this off air, but we have kind of a little bit different takes on Alex Jones. Not, we don't love him, people. Neither of us love him. but Andrew, tell me what you think about him being banned, and mine is a little bit different.
Well, he also, I saw this morning that the Apple Store has removed the InfoWars Alex Jones app from its store. So, I mean, he is... like legitimately, like deplatformed, as they, you know, the new word that we're all learning. No, I mean,
but you can still go to www.infowars.com if you want to find him.
Yes, for now. No, I mean, mine is always, my feelings about it is always more, it always comes from a personal place, because my dad has followed and he's kind of like become more and more conspiratorial as he's gotten older, and like I've said before, my dad also subscribed to the Ron Paul letters of the 1990s that were racist, bigoted pieces of trash. You know, it's like it always brings up emotional stuff for me, because I've had actual like arguments with my dad where it is so frustrating to be sitting there with someone and try to argue about something, and someone's telling you things that aren't true, you know, and it's very, you know, so it's like, for me, I get the whole, you know, like it's a bad precedent and stuff like that, but I just can't help it. You know, like, he's so destructive and he has led people down such horrible roads that, you know, and there's lots of other people like him too, you know, that I think, you know, that at least should, that's why I got so upset when Megyn Kelly last year had him on, you know, for a show. It's like his star has definitely been ascendant in the alt-right age. And the guy is a union socialist. Like, that's,
right.
Trust me.
Not,
I know my, yeah, I know my dad, and he is a Alex Jones is a union socialist, so I don't know how people say that he's on the right. But anyways, that's basically how I feel about it, and it mostly comes, like I said, from a place of like personal hurts and stuff like that. So I know I'm probably right. Like have a much different like take and bias on this stuff. So,
but you've kind of said too, and if I'm putting words in your mouth, I apologize, but that banning him only makes him stronger.
Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, I do think that because I know my dad, it cements in his mind, well, they're afraid of his truth being out there.
Yeah.
That is what I really have. You know, I do think that it makes his followers, who are conspiratorial minded and believe everything Alex Jones says, that they're like, oh, yep, see, they're shutting him down. He's definitely right. And then and then other people are curious, like, well, why are they? You know, it's like, and as we've seen with the whole, you know, Zena Bash thing, there's a lot of people that are conspiracy theory minded. I mean, you even go back to, I saw on Twitter, somebody brought up, Ben Sasse brought up the fact that, you know, so many people, in the, you know, early 2000s and even now, you know, think that George Bush had something to do with 9/11, including people who are mainstreamed, like CNN's Van Jones. And you know my feelings.
Yes, that is a very personal opinion too. Andrea hates Van Jones, and I think he's likable. A communist that's likable.
Anyway, so sorry, I forgot that nuance that I had the other day.
Well, as far as how I view Alex Jones, I can't stand him, obviously. And my feeling when I heard that he was banned and InfoWars was banned, and people might hate me for saying this, but I have basically already said it, but I kind of felt bad that I didn't feel bad about it. And I obviously think he spews lies and poison, and I don't know even as much about him as plenty of other people, but from what I've heard and read and what I know about him, he's someone that conservatives shouldn't idolize. He's not a martyr. He isn't anyone we want on, quote, our side. And I wrote a piece at Red State yesterday, "Dear Conservatives, : stop treating Alex Jones like a martyr." And I said at the very bottom, I would fully defend his right to free speech and protection of his free speech from governmental intervention. But Twitter deciding to ban him and them as a private company making their own decision, I support that. And I can't stand Jones, but I would defend his right to free speech. But this isn't a free speech issue. Now, does it set a dangerous precedent? I mean, when people like him are removed, I mean, sure. Yeah. Do I think eventually someday, like, you and I might be considered extreme in our thoughts because of what we're saying as conservatives? Probably. And that's an issue. But as of right now, I am not really shedding a tear over Alex Jones. So
yeah,
that's my terrible take.
Yeah, the one thing about Twitter is that, you know, I honestly do believe that Alex Jones, you know, has probably violated terms of service. You know, but at the same time, it's like, and that's their own prerogative. People forget that these are private companies. They think that they have this public. It's a public forum, and so and it's free, and so it is therefore a part of the public space. No, it's not, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, it's these companies that, you know, and like we talked about, I can't remember if it was last week or the week before, where we're in this kind of wild, wild west of social media. Yeah. We're still barely, you know, 15 years into it, really. I never participated in like the blog or really, my first boyfriend I met in a AOL chat room, I guess. Like, and all of my boyfriends, like I am definitely like the, you know, every single guy I've ever been on a date with, I met online somehow, you know, the guy I'm marrying met him on, you know, Twitter. And so it's like, you have these, you know, it's like, I am definitely one of those people. And that's the thing. Guys also up here in the Pacific Northwest, at least, I always said, like, look, the reason why I've only dated people that I've met online is because no one ever asked me out to my face that I, like, other than, like, creepy old guys, you know? and that happened, like, you know, that's happened, like, not even a handful of times, you know? So it's like, I never got asked out, and it's like, oh, because you're intimidating. And it's like, okay, but still, I'd be single for the rest of my life if I didn't, you know? Anyway, but so there's my beef with men. but there is something that we share the same controversial opinion about a food. Well, it's a drink, but
which is kind of groundbreaking because usually you and I are complete opposites when it comes to food preference.
Yeah, I know. And this is like, you live in the South, so I can only imagine that it's way worse down there such a controversial. So what did you tweet about?
Well, I tweeted just because I like to break up the politics with controversial food takes, because the hate from controversial food takes is kind of fun and it kind of energizes me for more politics,
yeah,
which is twisted. But I tweeted that, and this is true, I'm from the North. I'm originally from up there, and I live in the South now, and I don't like sweet tea. I think it's disgusting, mm-hmm. and I prefer unsweet tea, and I always ask for unsweet tea, and if I'm mistakenly given sweet tea, I send it back because it tastes it's disgusting, whether you add sugar or simple syrup to it or something. It's gross. So I hate sweet tea.
Yeah, I
can't. People lost their minds. And I had to mute the conversation because I was getting so much hate. Well, you've never had the sweet tea that my grandma's made. No, I haven't had the sweet tea that your grandma's made, but I've had sweet tea. Ugh.
But yeah, you agree, it's like, with me. It doesn't, you know, there's nothing that I love more than like sun tea, you know, but, and I maybe put like a little bit of sugar in that. But yeah, sweet tea is just... there is tea that you add a little bit, or like iced tea, then there's unsweetened, which is my favorite, then there's regular, like, oh, you made this at home and you put a little bit of sugar in it, then there is sweet tea, which has like a cup of sugar in it.
Liquid diabetes.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's so bad. Now you are, you know, the mother of a Mississippian. Is he going to grow up thinking sweet tea is disgusting?
Oh, no. Well, no, he will grow up to think it's disgusting because we're not going to have sweet tea in our house because it's horrible and unhealthy and, you know, horrible. And I have a sweet tooth. I mean, I like chocolate and I like all that stuff, but I do not like sweet tea. And as we've discussed, one of the enjoyable aspects of tea is the bitterness that you can taste. When it's just sugar, it's just sad.
Yeah,
you can get sugar anywhere. You like the bitterness of the tea.
I just in general don't drink sweet drinks ever. Like, I mean, I have, even when it's like a diet soda, I'll get them once in a blue moon and it has to be fountain. I can't drink it out of a can or whatever. And
yeah,
but yeah, it's most of the time it's water or sparkling water. The sparkling water, like, revolution has been like a godsend for me because it's like you get the fizzy plus the, and people try to always insist that, oh, it's got an aftertaste. And my big thing, my biggest irritation is that when people like come over and over the first couple years that it was out, people would come over and they'd be like, oh, can I try one of your sparkling waters? And I'd be like, yeah, sure. And then they'd take like one or two sips and then decide that they didn't like it and that there would be a can left. So now if someone ever asks me, it is, yes, you can have one, but you have to drink the whole can.
They can bring their own sweet tea if they want to come over.
Exactly.
Oh,
crazy. Anyways, alrighty. Well, where can everyone reach you, Kim?
Everyone can reach me at Southern Keeks on Twitter, KEEKS, at Red State and Washington Examiner.
All right, and everybody can reach me at Andrea and Ruth and at redstate.com. And we'll talk to you next time on another episode of